From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. After the Justice Department concluded the Baltimore Police Department had routinely violated citizens' rights, Justice and the city last year agreed on a set of reforms to be enforced by federal judge James Bredar. He named a team to monitor police progress toward reforms, and that monitoring team has unveiled its plan for what the BPD needs to do when. The principal deputy monitor, former Washington Police Chief Charles Ramsey, told us why the team wants public comment.
Did we miss something? Are these the areas that are most concerned to you? Do you have some additional suggestions in that area? So we're going to provide an opportunity for community feedback before we present the final first-year monitoring plan to Judge Bredar.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. It's been 9 months since the City of Baltimore and the U.S. Department of Justice entered into an agreement to fix problems in how the City Police Department does its job. Problems including unjustified disparities in stop searches and arrests of African Americans, and excessive force identified in the DOJ's investigation of Baltimore police after the unrest in 2015. The agreement, called a consent decree, is enforced and overseen by U.S. District Judge James Bredar, who chose a monitoring team to help the Baltimore Police Department make reforms and to keep track of how it's doing. This week, the monitoring team unveiled a draft of its plan for monitoring the reforms. The public has 3 weeks to comment on it. Charles Ramsey, former police chief in Washington, D.C., former police commissioner in Philadelphia when those departments were going through the consent decree process, is the principal deputy monitor in the Baltimore case, and he is with me in studio to discuss the process. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I mentioned two consent decrees in which you were on the police side of things, and then you've also been on the monitoring team for several other cities. How many consent decrees have you been involved with?
Well, I'm currently involved in the consent decree in Cleveland and, of course, here in Baltimore. Philadelphia, we entered into something called collaborative reform, which is slightly different from a consent decree in that a court is not really involved. You work directly with the Justice Department in order to resolve problems, but they go through a lengthy investigation and make several recommendations. You have to come into compliance with recommendations and so forth. So it's very similar with the exception of the court. The arrangement I had in Washington, D.C. was the first time I'm told anyone, any police chief anyway, had actually asked the Justice Department to come in and take a look at their department. That was 1998.
You asked for it.
I asked for it. We had some issues that needed to be resolved, and quite frankly, we needed help. So I sent a letter to then Attorney General Janet Reno, whose deputy attorney at the time was Eric Holder, and asked for their assistance. They came in and, to their credit, provided a lot of support. Of course, we entered into a memorandum of agreement. They had very concrete recommendations that we had to come into compliance with, but it totally transformed that department. Without that move, I don't believe D.C. would be where it is today, quite frankly. So I've got a lot of experience in working with the Department of Justice and consent decrees, memorandum of agreement, collaborative reform, whatever you want to call it. There are areas that need to be addressed. And as a result of that, both the city and the department has to come into compliance.
Describe in simplest terms the role of the monitoring team.
Well, the monitor, who is Ken Thompson, a law partner at Venable here in Baltimore City, the monitor doesn't work for the city. It doesn't work for the police department. It doesn't work for the Department of Justice. We're agents for the court. So we report directly to Judge Bredar. Now, obviously, we work with all parties in order to get it accomplished. So, one, we have to make sure that the department is moving toward coming into compliance with the various paragraphs contained within the consent decree. There are 510 paragraphs that they need to come into compliance with. Technically, there's 511, but the 511 is really just definitions. And we bring in support in terms of technical assistance. So if there's a particular area where they need some more advice or they need someone to help them think through what those issues are, we do have members of the monitoring team that can provide that kind of expertise, whether it's in the area of technology, disciplinary processes, things of that nature. So we're actually independent. We work directly for the court, but we work in collaboration with all the parties.
Yeah, it's a big team. I mean, besides Ken Thompson and you, how many people?
Well, there's 20 altogether, not all working at the same time, obviously. It depends on the issue. We have various areas within the consent decree where we've brought on board people that have expertise in that particular area. Crisis intervention training, for an example, Dr. Randy DuPont, who actually created what is known as the Memphis model that most departments now have adopted in dealing with people that are going through some kind of mental health crisis. Other areas of the consent decree, he's not as involved. First Amendment investigation, Seth Rosenthal and myself are working with that, but we also have attorneys, civil rights attorneys, that have some experience in dealing with that. So it depends on the topic that we're addressing, and we can rotate people in and out, but it's a large team, but a very talented team.
What community organizations will the monitoring team work with?
Right now, we're working with the Baltimore Community Mediation Center. BCMC gets referred to as. Shantae Guy is the executive director. And she's been, and her group have been very, very helpful in organizing different meetings. We've had 4 community forums already. We will have regular community forums. Quarterly is what's required within the consent decree and other ways in which we can reach out. And we're in the process of coming up with a way in which we can hire liaisons to work in each of the 9 districts, police districts that exist here in the city of Baltimore. Anywhere from 1 to 3 people we would hire. These are people from that particular community that would be able to, again, create that link that we need to be able to work effectively with community, know what their concerns are, and have that kind of dialogue back and forth. So that's incredibly important, community engagement, which is a major piece of the consent decree, along with community policing. We also have websites. I mean, this is the 21st century, so obviously social media plays a role, Facebook, Twitter. We have our own website. We're going to be very aggressive in terms of getting feedback from community. And the whole point of this draft being put out this week is to give people 3 weeks to be able to respond and react to it. You know, did we miss something? Are these the areas that are most concerned to you? Do you have some additional suggestions in that area? So we're going to provide an opportunity for community feedback before we present the final monitoring plan, first-year monitoring plan, to Judge Bradar.
That's Charles Ramsey, Principal Deputy Monitor of the Consent Decree requiring reforms by the Baltimore Police Department, here on the record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. That draft monitoring plan out this week says, quote, "There is generally a logical progression for achieving sustainable reform in each area of the consent decree. BPD, Baltimore Police Department, first must establish revised policies in each area. Then it must develop and conduct training on those revised policies. It's only at that point that the monitoring team can comprehensively assess whether the new policies are taking root." Give me an example of how that plays out and how long that takes.
Well, use of force would be an area. There's currently policy guiding officers in terms of how and when they can use force in order to make an arrest. We want to review that policy, one, to make sure that it's a reflection of best practices as they exist around the country. And then we want to make sure that the training is such that officers really understand exactly how they're to use force and when they can use force, and also de-escalation is being a big part of that as well. So training now in policing has become less lecture and more scenario-driven. We call it reality-based training, where officers are actually put in situations and are judged based on how they exercise judgment in certain situations. Are they able to effectively de-escalate a situation? If they had to resort to force, what level of force? Is it appropriate? Are they doing everything they can to avoid using high levels of force to resolve a situation?
The plan calls for, by the end of this month, by the end of January, the police department should appoint an officer with the rank of sergeant or higher to serve as a crisis intervention coordinator. So that's even before there's policy and training changes.
Well, it is, but you need to have a go-to person. You have to have someone whose entire focus is going to be in this critical issue. You know, people don't call 911 to say good morning. They call because there's some issue going on. So whether or not there's someone who we're dealing with that has some form of mental illness, or if they're just at a heightened level of anxiety or stress, we still have to be able to effectively recognize it very quickly and try to de-escalate the situation best we can so that we don't have to resort to uses of force at all, if possible. Having someone there in the department that's our go-to person to make sure the policy is in place, to make sure the training is taking place, to follow up and review incidents that take place out there in the field, to make sure officers are actually utilizing the skills that they've been giving out there in the field. I mean, all that stuff is critically important.
By April, the department is supposed to draft a study on the state of its equipment, technology,
right,
and information infrastructure.
Baltimore's in pretty bad shape when it comes to technology. They're not alone. There are a lot of big cities that are in the same position. Their information systems are just not state-of-the-art. You need to be able to capture data if you want to be able to analyze and evaluate the progress that's being made. And so we have to do an evaluation of what they currently have, the state of the equipment. They have an aging fleet of vehicles, for an example. They need more computers. They need more modern systems to communicate just in general. So that's all part of it, because a lot of the requirements within the consent decree is going to require them to really upgrade their systems and their equipment. And that's not just in the best interest of the Baltimore Police Department, but the citizens of the city. I mean, you know, they need a modern police force, and we're going to help them get there.
Just a month later, then, the department is to complete a comprehensive staffing study to determine, quote, the appropriate number of officers needed in the city and detail deployment across the city.
That's critically important. Right now, they have officers that are working extended shifts because of personnel shortages. Baltimore, like cities across the country, have faced a challenge when it comes to recruiting individuals into the ranks of policing. Some of that has to do with a lot of the negative publicity policing's gotten over the last couple of years, other options that are available to young people. So we have to be very aggressive and market police departments a lot differently, but really bring more people into the ranks. Now, having said that, that's not where it ends. You have to be able to make sure that they're deployed properly. How many detectives do you need based on workload? I mean, there are a lot of moving parts in any police department, and so it has to be a comprehensive staffing study done in order to make sure that not only do they have the numbers, but are they deployed in a manner that's consistent with the needs.
Short break here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with former Washington, D.C. Police Chief and Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey, who is now the principal deputy monitor of the consent decree between the City of Baltimore and the U.S. Justice Department. And when we're back, who pays for this? I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Charles Ramsey, former Washington, D.C. police chief, former Philadelphia police commissioner, former co-chair in 2015 of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, who is the principal deputy monitor of the consent decree between the City of Baltimore and the U.S. Justice Department. The monitoring team released its draft plan this week and is asking the public to comment on it before January 29th. Commissioner Ramsey, we'll put the comment links on the WYPR website, but broadly, what impact can the public have?
Well, hopefully they have a great impact because they are the consumers of policing here in the city of Baltimore, either to prevent crime from occurring, if crime occurs, having an investigation of that crime, people that are committing crimes, having them taken off the street. I mean, so yeah, the public has a huge role, and I hope they take advantage of this opportunity to actually comment. I mean, we're serious about needing to have their input to make sure we're on the right track, and we'll also be providing regular feedback and reports. We're required by the consent decree twice a year to publish a report, kind of measuring the progress that the department is making. But also through these community forums we'll be having, we'll also be providing that kind of information and feedback. They can't expect everything to be fixed overnight because it's not going to happen that way. But at least being able to show measurable progress in certain key areas.
The team, the monitoring team, already held several community meetings late last year. What did you learn?
Well, we learned quite a bit, actually. Obviously, there's some frustration. I mean, you can expect that. But there were a lot of very, very concrete ideas that came and interest from community. Once we had the larger group, and again, the Baltimore Community Mediation Center kind of facilitated everything, we broke out into smaller groups where we looked at the various portions of the consent decree to really take a little deeper dive in terms of what people thought we ought to be looking at and what some of the issues are. We'll be posting those comments on our website, by the way, so people can actually see for themselves what comments were made. And I think it had a lot of influence. In fact, I know it had a lot of influence, even in helping us develop our first year monitoring plan, because we had to prioritize. You can't do everything at one time. And so what are those critical issues that we need to get at right away? And it was that community input. We looked at the DOJ investigation. Where did they focus mostly on? And what are some of those areas that we think we can actually make some measurable progress in that first year? So community was incredibly important.
As I understand it, the act of monitoring this consent decree will cost the public about $1.5 million a year. Where does that money come from?
From the city. It's actually $1.4 million per year. That covers transportation, that covers lodging, that covers an hourly rate for the work that's being done by the various members of the team. It does not cover areas like, purchasing the technology equipment that's going to be needed. But the city has already set aside some additional money to be able to do that. So it's an expense, but the end result is going to be well worth it. And I experienced that both in D.C. and in Philadelphia. You have to make an investment if you want to see the kind of improvement that you deserve to have here.
Well, there's the investment in monitoring and then presumably a much bigger investment
right. In
the department to make these reforms. What kind of cost are we talking about for these reforms?
Well, you'd have to check with the city to get an exact number. But obviously, if we're looking at equipment, for an example, vehicles and things of that nature, you're looking at information systems, computers, things of that nature, the wireless network, the local area network, all these things, they cost money. Now, I don't know what the exact numbers are going to be. That's going to be up to the city to decide exactly what it is they're going to purchase, how much that is. But the bottom line is there are some requirements within the consent decree that they're going to have to come into compliance with, and there is a cost to that.
Well, and that's what I am wondering. Baltimore is always pleading with the state, for example, for more financial resources. What if the city and state don't come through with the financial support that the police department would need to make the reforms?
They have to come into compliance with the consent decree, period. This is a 5-year monitoring plan that we have. You've only seen the draft of the first year. They've got to come into compliance. So that's an issue that the city's going to have to work with the state and whoever else they feel is appropriate in order to have the funding required to come into compliance. But there's not an option.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Charles Ramsey, Principal Deputy Monitor of the Consent Decree between the City of Baltimore and the U.S. Justice Department. What kind of relationship does your team have with Mayor Pugh?
A good relationship. I mean, she was very active during the process where a monitor was selected. We had different groups that had applied, and she was present at some of those meetings and asked questions. She's really committed to this, and you have to give the mayor credit, and you have to give the police commissioner credit. They had an opportunity to back out of this consent decree with a new administration in Washington that's not going as aggressively toward police reform as the previous administration. And they both stood firm and said, no, we want this consent decree to move forward. She didn't have to do that. So the level of commitment on the part of the city, the level of commitment I've seen thus far within the department to make change is really encouraging. So I think the people should feel good about that. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but at least people aren't fighting what needs to happen.
What about the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police? Does the union have any part of this process?
Well, we keep them informed. One of the members of our monitoring team, Sean Smoot, is a vice president of a major union in Illinois. I've worked with him on numerous occasions. We were part of a Kennedy School executive session. He's on our team. He and I both met with the union and had focus groups with police officers because we want to hear not only from community, we also want to hear from the officers because they recognize there needs to be change. They recognize that they don't have everything they need to work with. And so we want to hear all voices in order to have as comprehensive a look at what's going on here in Baltimore and how we can best improve things that are taking place here and help bring the department into compliance.
How did the unions react in the other cities where you've worked on consent decrees?
It all depends. I mean, some unions are a little more resistant than others, but I've had none that really have been a roadblock in terms of just trying to prevent things from occurring in Washington, in Philadelphia. But they do need to be kept informed. They need to be kept in the loop because it's like everything else in any organization anywhere, not just policing. The minute you mention the word change, people get nervous. And so the way to combat that is by providing information. Let them know what's really going on and not let the rumor mill take hold, because then you've got problems.
What leverage does the monitoring team have? I mean, if the Baltimore Police Department doesn't make sufficient progress, you go to court?
We go to court. The remedy would be with Judge Berdar in court. That's a last-ditch effort. You hope you don't have to do that. He could impose penalties and things of that nature. I've not seen anything thus far in the process that would lead me to believe that that's going to become necessary. We've not had to do that in other places that I can think of. I'm sure that there have been some examples, but the ones I've personally been involved in. So that's always there. I mean, this is not an option. I mean, a consent decree is a consent decree. You have to come into compliance, period. Now, there may be some areas that will be more difficult and will take more time. For an example, you may have something in one of the paragraphs that will require negotiation with the union. So that may take a little more time because contracts, you have to wait for it to expire and then renegotiate and all those kinds of things. But barring that, we should be able to make some fairly decent progress, measurable progress in bringing the department into compliance, because they're on board, the city's on board, the Department of Justice. I mean, everybody really has focused on making this happen and make it work.
I was stunned, might overstate it, but really impressed with the level of detail in your work plan, your draft work plan. As you mentioned, there's 510 paragraphs to be addressed in the consent decree. It seems asking a lot of any institution or set of institutions to make all those changes at once. I mean, some of the changes may be synergistic and support each other. Some changes may be in competition with each other. How does this really work?
That's why you have to really sit down and kind of think about the ripple effect that change has within an organization. You can change one thing, and sure, that's the right thing to do. It brings into compliance. But do you really understand the ripple effect it has throughout the rest of the organization? You change one policy, do you now put it in conflict with other policies? So we have to really take an in-depth, thorough look. And we're relying on the department to a large extent to let us know any related directives, for an example, as we start to make changes, so that we can make sure that we can account for those kinds of things. But you're right, it's a very aggressive plan, but I truly do believe we can get it done.
I really appreciate you talking to us about it. Thank you.
It's quite all right. Be glad to come back.
We'll take you up on that. Charles Ramsey, former Washington, D.C. police chief, former Philadelphia police commissioner, former co-chair of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, now the principal deputy monitor of the consent decree between the city of Baltimore and the U.S. Justice Department. The monitoring team released its draft plan this week and welcomes public comment on it until January 29th. At the On the Record page at WIPR, we have links to the monitor's plan and how you can comment on it. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been with us today. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.